She was warned. She was given an explanation. Nevertheless, she persisted.
Joining me today as we discuss sexism in academia is Dr. Bonnie Wasilek. In case you aren't familiar with her name, you are about to find out why you should be. I want to give all of our listeners a brief rundown of Dr. Wasilek's accomplishments and highlight the importance of her work. Dr. Wasilek received her PhD from the School of Teaching, Learning, and Curriculum Studies at Kent State University. Her work considers questions of social justice, qualitative research methods, and teaching practices that focus on the examination of race, gender, and sexual orientation in schools. She is the recipient of the 2012 James T. Sears Award for her paper titled "The Nested Nature of Mothering: Complicating Curriculum Conversations." She earned a 2016 Outstanding Dissertation Recognition Award from Division B, Curriculum Studies, of the American Educational Research Association for her doctoral dissertation, which is called "The Presence of Absence: The Negotiation of Space and Place for Students of Color at a Predominantly White Suburban High School." Her dissertation was also a finalist for two other internationally recognized dissertation awards in 2016 and 2017. She was recently inducted into the University of Michigan's National Center for Institutional Diversity. In addition to publications, conference presentations, and invited talks, she is a founding editor for the International Journal of Curriculum and Social Justice. Dr. Wasilek teaches high school, where she has started a gender and sexuality alliance at each of the high schools she has worked. She also leads professional development in the areas of anti-racist, anti-homophobic, and anti-transphobic practices for K-12 educators and on social justice more generally. Recent publications include an article on what she calls the school-to-coffin pipeline for queer and questioning youth for a special issue of Cultural Studies, Critical Methodologies on Critical Studies of Girlhood. Dr. Wasilek, welcome and thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
So, you're obviously not only an expert in your field, but you have a vital, you're a vital piece of moving forward the conversation dealing with marginalized student populations. And one, thank you for that. You do awesome work. So those familiar with your work and accomplishments, as all of the She Who Persisted podcast listeners are now, know that you have spent a considerable amount of time in academia, both as a student and a professional. So let's get down to it. What are your personal experiences with sexism, racism, or other types of discriminatory behavior in academia?
Well, I'm new as far as experiencing things for several years and ongoing experiences with questions of sexism and racism. I guess what I can speak to first and foremost are the experiences that I've had on several levels. As a woman and a woman of color in K-12 schools, where I've spent the last decade of my career, and then sort of moved forward from there. Part of the complication is that not only as a woman of color in predominantly white schools that I've experienced questions of race and gender from your staff, from your students, a lot of questions. I look very Latina, although my dad is from India, and so my mom is Norwegian, and so I came out looking as I do. And so particularly I've taught Spanish for the last decade, and so that sort of trips people up. So there's always the ways that you are identified as a person in general. I think as a woman of color, there's another layer of question of how you identify yourself and then how other people identify you. And so a lot of the work that I do has extended from these really sort of personal challenges. I wrote about them in a paper for a book on racial battle fatigue, specifically what this looks like on a daily basis for women of color in academia and in K-12 schools, just sort of the daily fatigue that you face when there are questions of race and sexism, and then what that means necessarily for LGBTQ students. So on one hand, I live this life where people will look at me and they'll say, well, this is a person who I identify in this particular way, and so therefore she must be X or Y. I think that a lot of us, regardless of gender, regardless of race, regardless of sexual orientation, gender identity or expression, sort of experience these things. But then that second layer of question of sexual orientation, gender identity and expression, right? So you have your own question of identity, which is sort of always in conflict or many times in conflict with the ways that you are identified. And not facing that struggle is that question of privilege. What do we have the privilege to ignore? What do we have the privilege to not experience in our lives? I think that, unfortunately, my story is not unusual. I've been called spic. I've been called a lot of things. And then that second layer of getting the degree. So I received my doctorate and received pushback from a lot of people in a lot of different ways. So there was a question of, I had somebody say to me, isn't it being disrespectful to your husband if you want to be known as Dr. Wozlik rather than Mrs. Wozlik? And so that's at sort of, again, that local K-12 level, where on one hand, we're expecting more and more teachers to continue education, right? That's a requirement of keeping your licensure that require this education. But too much education is seen as it should be, in a way, a question of privilege. What is the privilege that we have to be able to get these doctorates? But too much is not good, and not enough will not allow you to keep your license. And so as a woman, then there's that second question of, well, do you have too much education, particularly in this Midwestern context, where I've had several people say to me, well, you should actually put it as Mrs. and then in parentheses, doctor. And when I say, should a man have to do that as well? Well, of course not. Of course, that's a different context, and men getting degrees are different. And even students who will say to me, I think it's so unusual. I don't think of you as a doctor, or I have trouble thinking of you as a doctor. We have one other colleague in our school who is male, happens to be white and male, who has his doctorate. And the students will say, well, I've had them on the verge of things, right? So they'll say to me things like, well, it's different for him because it just fits more for a man to have this degree.
Right. Because he just looks the part, huh?
He just looks the part, right. And then on the second level, the same level of an academic question, you know, of being in the academy, I've had people ask me questions like, well, how are you as a young mother looking at balancing your life? Do you think that you can balance scholarship and being a mother and work? And I think to myself, how often would you ask a man that question? Would there ever be a question either in an interview setting or even just among colleagues of how do you balance these things? And I look at it as I had my first child in the middle of my doctoral program. I not only completed my program and wrote five publications, including my dissertation, two of which were in the dissertation and another publication, which were award-winning and did presentations. None of those things are actually good enough. Sometimes I feel like there's still that question of, well, are you planning on having more kids and what will that life-work balance look like? And not that I mind the answer, because we are, at the end of the day, people, and we do have, there's always a question of life-work balance. But again, are we asking those questions of men? Are we more reticent toward men in this field or any field for that matter, wondering how are they going to make that balance? How are they going to make that transition? So,
absolutely. Do you have or have you noticed any difficulties with people trying to rationalize as far as finding another job in a K-12 setting with your doctorate? Is you feel that that's a more difficult thing to do as a female doctorate versus a male doctorate, or does that not really come into play? Or in general, with a PhD, they say move on to something else.
In a K-12 setting, once you have too much education, you're not employable. And so this has nothing to do, I think, with a doctorate, but more to do with our system as a general statement, where if you have too much education, you're too high on the pay scale. Or the same sort of thing actually happens with work experience, right? So if you are too experienced as a teacher, you're no longer employable by a lot of districts because they just can't afford to pay that amount just because of the way the public education system is set up, particularly here in this area.
Yeah, well, and with cuts to education, that doesn't help anything either.
Right, that's exactly it.
So do you happen to know what the gender breakdown is of your field?
I don't know the exact gender breakdown. So to be fair, there are a couple of questions that sort of fall in here when we're thinking about questions of gender in the field. On one hand, the education still tends to be overwhelmingly female in particular ways. So by that, I mean that we still have a lot of female teachers. But when we're thinking about the system of schooling and we're thinking about hierarchies in schooling, it's going to be overwhelmingly male the more power you get in the system. Now, when you think about academic work, it's the same way. Although it's still considered a type of service work, education is. And so even in the academy, there are still questions of gender bias, although that's becoming more and more equal. I don't want to portray that it's necessarily equal, but what I will say is that there's still that inequity in questions of pay. There's that inequity in questions of power, who gets the jobs at the top and who doesn't. Things like that. So while I don't have an exact figure for you, it still is lopsided. But because it's considered a service field, that is one of the sort of key factors that sort of plays into what necessarily, I think, makes the differences in gender in the roles that we have and not necessarily in the overwhelming structure of who is a part of the education field, either in K-12 schools or in the academy.
So from what you've seen, whether it's in academia as a student or maybe in professional life, have you noticed some type of structural inequality that hold women back? It's just like it's that glass ceiling that we can't quite break yet, or at least a little trip along the way that makes it a little more difficult.
Well, I mean, I think that that's going to be, unfortunately, it's a sociocultural barrier that a lot of women and boundaries that a lot of women traverse. I know that as a woman of color, there's particularly some difficulty getting through those questions of the glass ceiling and what it means. You know, it can play out in a lot of really interesting ways. I don't think that that has gone anywhere necessarily. I don't think it's necessarily something that is particular to education. Although I have watched a lot of really brilliant women that I know go up for positions of power and not make it. And so this is not to say that they were less qualified than the men or more qualified than the men that they went up against. But there is a question of gender. There's definitely a question of race. And I think that we're still fighting those things. And I think that those are not necessarily, again, ingrained to just the field of education. I think that there's a question of sociocultural norms and values. It is the ideal of what is a woman's role? What is her role in education? What is her role in having a scholarship? And what does that mean? So, for example, a lot of the work that I do deals with the African-American intellectual tradition. And so when we think about people who are steeped in that tradition, scholars that have played an important role, if I were to say to you, well, quick, name some foundational scholars that thought about education, there will be some people that will say, okay, well, you know, Du Bois and Woodson. Great. And those are really good scholars. But people aren't talking about the role that Sojourner Truth or Mary McLeod Bethune or Anna Julia Cooper had in education, because they had a voice at a time when it wasn't just about them being women. It was about them being women of color, when some of the laws were really sort of against, the laws and sociocultural norms and values were really against everything that they did. And now we still have access to that scholarship, and a lot of that scholarship is indeed free. But they're not the ones, by and large, that are cited in several different fields. So we continually overlook their voices when their voices sometimes made the exact same point as some of the men who were also writing and speaking at the time. But it's a voice of a woman of color. And then if you were to add, for example, a twist of queer voices on top of that, well, what is too much? Can you be too much of a minority? I think this is something that I question a lot. So is it enough that I'm a woman of color? Is it too much if I'm queer? Is it too much if I'm disabled? Is it too much if I no longer speak the English language as my first language? And so we ask these questions, I think. What does it necessarily mean to be too much of a minority? And then when we're thinking about getting those jobs, well, have I officially checked too many boxes of what it necessarily means, right? So there's an initiative to hire minorities, but can you be too many of one minority in one box? I don't know. I think that's a question that we need to ask ourselves too. Not necessarily, it's again, aside from qualifications, I think that you should be qualified for the jobs that you go up for. At the same time,
absolutely,
there's a second layer of questions of being marginalized populations and what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, and what's too much marginalization in one person.
Right. These boxes that everybody seems to possibly fit in various ways are not necessarily things that we put upon ourselves, right? It's a societal thing. Like you said, it just permeates society. It's not just in academia. But for any minority, whether it's in academia or otherwise, how would you suggest that we should go about action to start to change the social narrative? Is it just raising our voices a little bit? What are the actions that we can do to start to shift it a little bit? I mean, we do have to rely upon allies as well. So do we start there, either trying to persuade our allies, or do we start in other avenues?
Well, I don't think anytime somebody tells you that there's a silver bullet, I'm wary of the idea.
Right.
Just because then we're talking about a bullet, and I don't think that we need to shoot anything necessarily, right. Although sometimes we certainly do. I think that I don't want to be formulaic about it, in other words. And
absolutely.
So I think that there are many ways to start. There's always a question of an ally or an accomplice. And a lot of people are making that distinction these days between somebody who will just stand beside you and who's willing to literally break the law to stand
right.
beside you. And
right.
I think that as people, we have to ask ourselves a couple of questions, right? And one of the questions that we have to ask ourselves is, how far are we willing to go? What is our personal line? And I'll say this, one of my mentors, my dissertation chair, in fact, and my mentor in grad school had said to me when I was a master's student, in fact, when I had him in class, had said, as a teacher, you have to decide when you are going to cease being a teacher and start being a person. And I used to think, wow, that is a really weird line to have. And the longer I kept teaching, the more I realized that these are the lines that we have, right? You have to ask yourself, at what point in time am I not going to fall in line?
Right.
At what point in time am I not going to be compliant? Because that's my moral line. That is my ethical obligation as a person. And
right. What do your students need
right.
from you? Really
yeah.
need.
Really need, right? And that's my line. And my line is hard fast to my own personal moral and ethical obligations. I know what those are now. I think it takes a while when you first start in the education field to figure that out.
Right.
And so on one hand, there's that question of an ally or an accomplice, and what role do we want to play? What role must we play to help change society? And I think it's a question of showing up, right? So I work with the LGBTQ community quite a bit, youth community in particular. And I show up for whatever it is, whether
right.
it is emotional support or it's an event, I show up for them.
Yes.
And so I think that there's a question of presence. What does your presence say as a part of any movement?
Absolutely.
And I think that if you're looking at a question of, am I an ally or am I an accomplice in any attempt to make sociocultural change to the norms and values that we have held so dear to us. I think that...
I don't know about dear, but...
Yeah, right. Well, I think it's been normalized, right? So
yes.
whatever it is that's been normalized, and you're trying to change something that's been normalized, you know, I think there's got to be a question then of... when you show up, are you showing up for yourself, or are you really showing up for other people?
Right.
And what does that mean? How does that change the perspective of what you do? And I think that there are little things that we do also. I think in the academic world, there's so many paths. There's a question of writing. And what does writing about it tell you, right? So one of the things that I just did this summer is I was working with women, thinking with women in India who were victims of domestic violence. And so I went to a shelter there and I thought with them about questions of violence. And so part of the best thing I can do for them at this moment is twofold, right? On one hand, I've been writing about the experience. I've been working towards some publications so that their story doesn't just stay where they're at.
Yeah, bring light to it.
That's exactly it. And on the other hand, you know, I have been doing some active things. In other words, trying to get like sanitary napkins, like pads and tampons and toothbrushes and toothpaste and things like that to them. So it's a question of what is the next step of social justice for me? For me, social justice is action oriented. But that doesn't mean that is the only way to do social justice work. So if what you can do is write, then that's something. If what you can do is go to the streets, then that's something. If what you can do is provide something for other people, then that's something. I think the one thing that we cannot do is just sit and wait for it to happen. I have a 5-year-old, and so I like to believe anyway that some of the things that I do with her on a daily basis is a question of social justice. Right. So when she asked me the other day, are all people, if I'm born a girl and I stay a girl, are all people who are born girls stay girls? And the answer is no. So now we're getting into questions of gender identity and expression. And I'm talking to my 5-year-old about what that means. Now she's really young and very impressionable. And on one hand, I do think that there are topics that only adults should be talking about that maybe she shouldn't have to wrap her mind around at this moment in time. But there are other ways to talk to her about the world and about people and expose her to the world and people and the beautiful diversity that is. And I think that is one way to work towards social justice on an incredibly local level. And I think that it's about walking the walk. I think that if we're just talking about it and in our daily lives, we're not working towards something as a person. So I think about one of the things I was just writing about is the image of Sankofa and being reflexive in yourself. And what does it mean to be reflexive in who we are on a daily basis to sort of interrogate our own selves? So that's a much more, again, local level. And then we keep unfolding it from there. I think that people are always going to be in moments of their own comfort zone, whatever that is. But then how do we break out of that? And then what is the next step after that too? So when we think about what can we do, do is a really, it's an active word that has so many possibilities. And I don't want to cut off the possibilities or the sets of possibilities that people work in to pursue questions of social justice, because for me, it's social justice is a question of equity and access. And so what are we doing to provide that equity and to give access if we have the privilege of giving it? I'm really lucky because no matter where I came from in my life, I do hold a doctorate. That is a position of privilege. And if I'm not going to take that role and that responsibility very seriously, then I'm not really doing my job with the privilege that I have, the privilege that I've been given. So when I think about my own questions of either sexual orientation or gender or gender identity and expression or even race, then there are questions of who has more privilege than me in those things, right? On the other hand, what do I do with the privilege that I do have? And what do I do with my marginalized self to make sure that that's also sort of putting out or the values that I wish that the rest of my community would espouse in some way.
Right. I like that you brought your daughter into the conversation here. You're touching upon the very youngest generation that we have coming up. So you're working in your group of age and also helping raise the next group. Have you, I know she's young, you said 5, she's not quite 6 yet, but doesn't it ever strike you sometimes the simplicity to some of the answers that children ask when it's like our world has made it a very complicated issue sometimes when it comes to marginalized groups? Like my daughter has started asking why did we have slavery? You know, why did people do that? She just cannot wrap her mind around it. And when you start to explain it to a six-year-old and you break it down in the very simplest terms, it's kind of frustrating that we're still having issues with these type of things. Why are we still having problems with race when a child can see that there's a problem with racism, you know, sexism? Why couldn't women vote, Mom? I don't get it. And when you start to explain, well, men thought that women were not capable of handling that responsibility. Her face in just total shock. How can that be? And so I find a lot of hope in the young children when their innocence, I suppose, as long as we can, as adults, keep them along that line, you know, teach them equality and how to go about that and to stand up for others and say, no, this isn't right when things start to move backward or you see an injustice. It's just really something.
Yeah, you know, it is. But I think on the other hand, because I still work with the K-12 population, and I actually started my career teaching elementary school students. And that was pre-K to second, and then moved to the middle school, and now have been doing high school work. At the same time, while I think that it feels infuriating when my daughter asks me these questions, along very, really similar lines too, I think quite the opposite is happening in other homes where their children are being taught hatred right off the bat.
Right.
And so, you know, as much as I think to myself, wow, this is such a simple solution, or to me, it's a really easy answer. I encounter students who, on a daily basis, cannot wrap their head around why there would be equal rights, for example, our LGBTQ community. You know, one of the big challenges, quote unquote, these days is a question of restroom use for our trans and gender fluid populations. And so people are saying, well, I don't understand why they should be allowed into any bathroom that they choose. Doesn't their choice to urinate next to me, doesn't that violate my rights? And I'm thinking, it's urine.
Right, exactly. They have to pee.
That let's get over it.
Everyone
for a minute.
Pee.
Yeah. And in the same way that I look at it as, wow, that is a really easy solution. A lot of these things for me are very easy solutions. And for some of my students and some of my colleagues, quite frankly, these are not easy solutions.
Right.
You know, I was in a professional academic setting, actually, at a conference where I was talking about what I call queer battle fatigue. And I had published a paper with two of my LGBTQ students from the Gender and Sexualities Alliance. And I went round with this guy for maybe a good 3 minutes, where his only question was wanting to know what my sexual orientation is. He kept asking in different ways until actually it was other people that were not presenting that sort of shut him down and said, like, this is not appropriate.
Right.
And I kept saying, this is not about me or my story. This is actually about my daughter. This is about these kids. I love them that much sometimes. But, yeah, you know, this is about my co-authors. This is not about me. This is about other people. And it really took this person who's highly educated a while to recognize why that would be rude. Why that's not necessary in that particular context, but in general. And so this is, now I'm thinking, well, this is somebody who's educated. So what happens when people have not received formal training for or toward questions of acceptance, and they're still stuck at a question of tolerance? So
right. Well,
I think that
this is why you start the workshops, right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I think that, and I do that for K-12 colleagues in particular, because again, there's this question for me, it's a really simple answer. For a lot of people, it's
right.
not so simple. And I don't think that it's frustrating for me when that's where they are, but I want to provide the opportunities to help them gain some education, some vital education, because when
right.
we think about schools, on one hand, I want them to have the education because I would hope that they become better teachers, that they become more reflective teachers. At the end of the day, I want them to have the education, because who they're hurting are kids. So these decisions we have, when we think about affect in education, and if we think about affect in this, you know, sort of reciprocal light, if we think about it sort of existing on bodies and between bodies, then what they do affects children. And that's something that we need to work toward also. So if we think about the larger circle of, or the larger implications of our actions, then I think now we're thinking through what does it mean to have an affect on a child? And then if I am affecting a child, what does that mean for how I'm affecting the system of schooling? What does that mean for how that system of schooling interacts with broader culture? And so I think that on one hand, I don't want to give too much power, but on the other hand, we have, there's a question of agency, and the agency that we have to affect children at a local level, schools and schooling at less local levels, and at quite less local level of broader cultural values. And what does that mean? So again, these questions that are really easy for me are not easy for other people. And then there's a question, right, what do you do with that? So that's what we move toward, is that next question of what do you do with that? And there's so many answers toward it. I don't want to, again, be prescriptive about it.
Right.
But at the same time, action is good.
Right. Yes. Engage everyone in the discussion.
Right. Right.
Yeah. It's amazing. Really. I'm telling you, I'm so happy you're doing what you're doing. So I know that we covered a lot of your projects in the introduction, but I know that you're always working on something, and by something, I mean lots of things. So can you tell us a little bit more about what you're currently working on?
Sure. Well, the studies that I've done with the LGBTQ youth are just sort of wrapping up. Although the work that I do with the gender and sexuality alliances are always ongoing. The groups that I run sort of that have fallen from that. So one of the things that I do is a group called GSA Advisors and Allies, which actually gives support to the advisors. So how do you support the people who are supporting the kids? And that just basically puts people in touch with broader community members. So it's a question for me of, are those advisors in touch with national and local groups for suicide awareness, for a lot of other things that are going to be helpful to kids? I've sort of finished anyway the work for the moment anyway with the Rape Crisis Center in Indiana, and started working on the theorization of that. I still have an ongoing project actually where I'm working with a small group of women in Appalachia. And they are all women who were engaged or married around the time of World War II. And so that question of what does it mean to be a woman as the men went off to war, a little bit of an odd twist, it's a mining community. And so their life expectations were a little bit different than we just went to work. A lot of them had actually already been working. So it's a question of femininity and jobs and what does that mean necessarily for the jobs that we hold and keep? And so other than that, a couple of chapters that are being put out right now. I just finished writing one where I use the work from the women in India to talk about what I call assemblages of violence. So if we think of assemblages as these pieces, these cultural pieces that we have that land on us as people. That next step, as Jasmine Puar would talk about from intersectionality, so we have all this intersectionality talk, but I think of it more in questions of assemblages. And what are the assemblages of violence that allow sociocultural violence to happen? And that's not just physically with questions of rape and domestic violence, but what are those assemblages that have allowed this violence to happen in schools as well? So this continuing ongoing violence against students of color, against our girls, and what are the pieces that work sort of in conjunction to normalize violence, whether it's emotional violence or physical violence that sort of has happened, right? So again, going back to that foundational literature, Anna Julia Cooper did a wonderful job of writing about these things, the violence that we have toward our girls in schools, and particularly our girls of color. And Woodson does this, again, fantastic job of writing about these things. And here we are in 2017 with reports of violence coming out again. What are the assembly issues that have historically and in contemporary senses allowed us to continue these violence, questions of violence against people of color and girls, and the LGBTQ community, and question of ability, all of those things together. And then going back to questions of suicide, so I'm doing some work on sounded suicide and what does suicide mean for our youth, and what are the sonic implications of that. So some of the work that I do sort of lays heavily within the question of sound. And we talk a lot about suicide in the question of physical signs, but we don't talk a lot about the sonic signs of suicide and what that necessarily means. And so these are sort of the projects that I've been thinking about, working through, and then just the general work that I've been doing, obviously, with the GSA and with students. So today was actually the Day of Silence. I'm talking a lot for a silent person. and so we had actually 100-plus students participate in that.
Wonderful.
So tomorrow we actually have a clothing swap where we are getting together, and it's specifically designed so that trans students can swap in affordable ways clothing. And so we've had a lot of really great donations, and they'll get together. And then a lot of portion of our proceeds will actually go toward a binder program that is here, a local binder program that's here that works with giving undergarments to trans youth. And then next week, I'm going to be teaching a pre-conference seminar with one of my wonderful colleagues from Miami University for AERA, and then making a couple presentations at that conference. So.
Fantastic.
I think that pretty much sums it up for the moment. I have some other like little projects or big, however you want to look at it. So I've been putting together and added a volume on Black Lives Matter as it specifically relates to education, and looking to land a contract for a special issue for a journal that will look specifically at the School to Coffin Pipeline and Queer Battle Fatigue, from a lot of different angles of education, too. So those are sort of my other academic projects that I've been working toward as well. So
that's awesome. You are very, very busy.
Yeah, a little bit busy, yeah. Yes,
it is. A little bit busy.
Yeah, at the same time, I do still work full-time, and I have my beautiful 5-year-old, and I'm actually 30 weeks pregnant, so I'm...
Yay!
you know, dealing with a little one inside of you while you're trying to do these things is an interesting moment.
Yes. Yeah, just a little snapshot of your life. I'm sure you've heard from many people, this will be over before you know it, but when you're in the moment, I'm sure the exhaustion does not feel great.
No, yeah, it's exhaustion, and it's also the expectation, right? So we have this idea of motherhood is this beautiful thing, as people will say, and how beautiful that you're pregnant, and how beautiful that you are going through becoming a mom or growing life inside of you. And at the same time, we don't talk about all the other sides of pregnancy and all the other sides of being a mother, particularly a new mother. So on one hand, I'm massively pregnant, and I'm a school teacher, and my students see that I'm massively pregnant, but I've been told not to talk about pregnancy necessarily, as it's quote too personal unquote to share with students, and not the sides of pregnancy that maybe, again, the line of what students should or shouldn't know, but really basic things like I'm tired or I feel a little nauseous. So if those are the things we skip over, in this miracle of life, I'm always a little curious as to, you know, what we're doing in education, because we're working to educate children, but about bodies and about, being parts of society, but not too much, at the end of the day. If I, for example, tell, as I did two boys who were being disrespectful, not only were you disrespectful to me as a teacher, but you were also disrespectful to me as a pregnant woman. The telling them that I'm a teacher part was okay, apparently, but then reminding them that I'm a pregnant woman was over the line. which is always interesting to me, right? Because I think that we should be teaching our young boys and girls that you do take care of women who are pregnant.
Yes.
Just like you should think about taking care of the elderly, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's a question of care.
Right.
Where do we allow our care to fall, and what does that look like? What does caring look like? You know, in a very female part of the part of the profession that's female dominated, now we're asking questions of care, but not too much care that's too feminine. Let's make sure that we
right.
care in particular ways that are going to be socially acceptable. So,
right. Excellent. So where can our listeners find you on the internet?
Everywhere.
Everywhere. Just Google Dr. Bonnie Wasley.
Google, yeah. No, I do have an academia.edu page where you can find a lot of my publications. I do tend to only put the publications that are out rather than things that are in press or in progress there. But my
right.
publications to date are there as well. You could also email me at bwozlek, W-O-Z-O-L-E-K, at kent.edu. I think that's about it.
Great. Well, one more thing before we end this wonderful, fascinating interview. When someone talks to me about the idea of feminism in academia, you are the woman that comes to my mind. And the story that resonates with me as a mother in academia myself is, if you're willing to share, a story about when you had to leave your daughter when she was just little, but you were still nursing, and you had to pump at a conference, but you didn't actually leave the room to do it. So do you remember this? You told me, I was just so...
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking about two stories, actually.
So I've only heard one. There's two badass stories.
There are a couple of ideas around questions of motherhood that get kind of complicated at these conferences. And in fact, I've been in touch with two of our larger conferences in the field, they were both very, very receptive to this idea of actually holding nursing rooms. So
right.
if there was a need to pump or a need to nurse, women would have a place to go, which it's 2017, and prior to 2016, 2017, that was not a conversation that, as far as I could tell, that a lot of conferences were actually having.
Right.
And the same thing about gender-neutral bathrooms. So we have all this queer talk and queer scholarship, but we don't have gender-neutral bathrooms. And the two conferences, the Bergamo Conference, which is here in Ohio every year for curriculum studies, and the American Educational Studies Association, they both have been wonderful as far as being receptive to this idea of, yeah, maybe we should have a gender-neutral bathroom. Maybe we should have, you know, a place for a woman to breastfeed or to pump. And so the first is that, yeah, I was up in Vancouver and I was still pumping at the time. I had to leave my child behind. It was the first trip that I'd taken as a new mother away from my daughter. And so I still wanted to be able to breastfeed when I came back. So I needed to pump. And I had gone to the conference officials and said, where can I do this? And they said, well, we don't have a place for you to be able to do that. And I was actually directed to a coat closet, but I was told, you can pump here in this coat closet, but at the same time, we can't guarantee that people will or will not be coming in and out. And that was absolutely right. So as I was pumping and the machine is making all of its wonderful noises, if you've pumped,
yeah.
you know that, and it's just sucking away in the corner, and there are people coming in and out to get their coats, and sort of half paying attention to me and half trying not to look at me and, at the same time being drawn to the fact that there's a woman in the corner trying to pump breast milk. And
right.
so that for me sort of inspired this need for a lot of the conferences that I frequent anyway to take care of women a little bit better than we have been.
Absolutely.
And then the other thing is just the award that I had won for the paper on mothering at the Curriculum and Pedagogy Conference. Actually, I had written it just a little bit after my daughter was born. All I could think of is we're having this conversation about sort of queering the normalization of, a lack of perspective or I guess a lack of interest in women's bodies, in women's histories, particularly in the field of education, and what a mother's body brings to the perspective of teaching and learning and things like that. And as I was asking these questions and writing about that, and I'm thinking, as I'm getting literally dressed up to go present at a conference, it was actually my third or fourth conference presentation ever, I'm thinking, I'm literally wondering how to queer the field in this space, and at the same time cover up my body in ways that are considered necessary to have a formal presentation space. And so before I left, I actually brought some of my milk and some Dixie cups. I don't know if this is what you're thinking about. But I had given, then at the end of my presentation, I said, before we think about, what we do with our spaces and what we do with our bodies, this is some of my breast milk. And if you'd like to test some, if you'd like to try some of the breast milk, please, by all means, let's have a little bit of a salute to womanhood and to mothering, and all of the implications that are a part of that. And so then handed out tiny little shots of my breast milk to anyone who wanted to have them. And I will say that some people actually got up from the table and left. And some people, as is their right, refused to partake in it. But it was really just a question of how do we ask again, what is normal, right? So we had coffee and cream around the corner from a cow, and I had actually boiled the milk for about 15 minutes after before I brought it in, so that it was a question of any question of safety was sort of there as much as I could. And at the same time, here we are. You know, people were literally offended. And even people at my own institution that were offended that a doctoral student had presented breast milk to the population. And again, it wasn't a requirement to drink it. It was just a possibility. If you wanted some, you could have some. And I had just given a large paper on mothering that included pictures of my postpartum body. So it's okay to look at pictures of a woman's body, but to experience parts of the body in different ways became a little bit much for some people. So that's, I think, the other, I don't know if there's a third.
Yeah, that, these are the stories that absolutely are what have made me think of you as a feminist in academia, braving these things, coming up with these ideas and walking the walk, as you said.
Well, I think it's part of our responsibility, particularly when, again, when we have the privilege to be in these spaces, we have fought, particularly some of us have fought for these spaces, whether it's a question of gender or a question, again, of race, women of color have made the spaces. And I'm not standing here alone. I'm here because there are women who have helped me personally, or they have culturally helped me, and I'm standing with them or on their shoulders or the platform that they built for me. I'm not doing that alone. I'm doing that with a community, whether it's the community that was or the community that is. And I can think of off the top of my head some incredible women who have made, for me, made the path. And I'm walking it in my own way, certainly, but the path exists because of them. And I want the path to continue existing and existing in with another set of possibilities because I've been on it too. And I think that those are the things that we do when we are trying to further, again, the sets of possibilities that we have through academic work.
Well, you're doing a wonderful job. And I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It has been wonderful.
Of course. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the She Who Persisted podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Pocket Casts, and TuneIn. We would love for you to subscribe to us, rate us, and review us. Our homepage is shewhopersisted.com. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at shepersistedpod. Our email is shewhopersistedpodcast@gmail.com. Please, 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 again, tell friends, family, acquaintances. They all need more nasty in their life. All right, guys, thanks for listening again. Stay nasty.